welcome to The Other Room. My name is Oreoluwa Leshi, or Ore as my friends and family call me. The Other Room is a podcast that features conversations with exceptional African women who are defining and redefining their roles in life. These are women who are charting their work and life journeys with purpose. We will look at their career trajectory, the challenges they might have had along the way, and the things they have learned on the path to where they are now. My work focuses on equipping girls and young women with the skills and confidence to prepare for fulfilling careers in science, technology, engineering, and maths. I do this through a non-profit organization called the Women's Technology Empowerment Center, WTEC, which I founded and is based in Lagos, Nigeria. I hope that my guest stories will help reaffirm that you are where you are meant to be, and if not, will encourage you to make important decisions about your next steps. Today, on The Other Room, we have Dr. Omolola Salako. Lola is a radiation oncologist specializing in the treatment of breast, head, and neck cancer. She is also the founder and executive director of Shebekli Cancer Care, an innovative cancer charity with a vision to empower and treat cancer patients. Omolola obtained her medical degree from the College of Medicine, University of Lagos. She completed her oncology residency in the Lagos University Teaching Hospital and obtained her fellowship from the Faculty of Radiology, West Africa College of Surgeons. Welcome, Lola. So tell us about your growing up. Where did you grow up? Did you grow up in Nigeria? What was your childhood like?
I come from a very large family. I grew up in Lagos, Nigeria. Born here, bred here, trained here, work here. So yeah, I grew up in Nigeria, but I would say something that stands in my childhood is the fact that I was allowed to explore. While my parents were particular about, okay, get a good education, they also encouraged being curious and, you know, finding out things and just generally exploring. Explore nature, explore life lessons. We were given tasks, especially my dad. You know, he'll give you tasks a bit harder or higher than your level, and then he'll watch you tackle it. And where you go wrong or where you're about to go wrong, he'll point you in the right directions. And there was always that very high level of responsibility he assigned, and which was well balanced with, of course, my mom and my stepmoms. They always had the feminine way of, you know, balancing it. I come from a really large family. We have 6 medical doctors, some lawyers, some engineers, some biochemists. My parents were very big on education. The nurture and love from my mom. My mom was just this powerful, hot, sexy woman with long black hair, red lipstick, red nails. And she was always with her briefcase, you know, working very closely with my dad. And, you know, it was that was just something I loved, that this woman is also mommyish and lovely. And at the same time, she's as strong as a man. That stood out for me as a child. I mean, I have to be this hardworking woman who knows what she wants. She's intelligent. When you get out, you speak your language, you know. So that was very clear from the beginning. Education, curiosity.
What did your parents do?
So my mom, she's an engineer. She's an engineer by training, but she's more than that. She's an entrepreneur. She's a negotiator. My dad, he's a full-time businessman, also an engineer by training. He's a farmer. He's into, you know, all types of business. And yeah, we run the business as a family business. There's the farm and all types of things. Yeah.
I think I can see that quality in you, not just doing one thing, but doing
Mm.
different things at the same time. I guess that's where you got it from.
Just explore something to pulls your fancy or you're curious about it. Go after it. Yeah, go after it. If it works, good. If it doesn't work, you return back to this and plot another strategy.
Okay. So how did you decide that you wanted to become a doctor, having two parents who are engineers by training, but also entrepreneurs?
Okay, so I'll put that on my dad. At that time, my dad was like, it's nice to have a white collar job. And I think my generation, most parents who wanted their children educated, were pushing their children into white collar jobs like medicine, law, and all of that. So it came naturally. And the family discussion at the table was always doctor, lawyer, engineer, things like that. So, and I'm a daddy's girl. He says, do medicine. You look like you'll succeed in medicine. I'm like, yes, dad. That was it. I just jumped into medicine. And and then I have siblings who are much older, and they are in medicine. And right ahead of me, I could see what they were doing and how they were achieving. And I remember my sister when she graduated, it was glorious. She graduated in UK, and my parents went in like coming to America. When the king went to the African king went to UK, and, they went in all their show, okay, Agbada, all of that. And, it was prestigious, and I was like, okay, when I'm graduating, I also want this sort of thing. So yes, I had my older ones also, encouraging me. I had them as inspiration. So yes, I'll say largely everything regarding the onset of my career started with my family's inspiration, guidance. Yeah.
Okay. And then so you also had role models in the medical line as well. So you kind of knew what to expect as you were advancing through university, I guess from UNILAG to
They like, yeah.
MEDILAG. Well, there's all the same university anyway. Okay, great. So then you graduated and then you started work, though I know medical students are working anyway before they
True.
graduate. So what was it like your first year as a newbie doctor?
Okay, so newbie doctor. There's this stark difference between being in school. School is protective, it's tedious, but it's protective. And then when you start as a house officer, a lot of responsibilities, thrust on you. So I found that challenging, and I started with pediatrics. And children are very sensitive. You have to be on your toes. You can't make any mistake. Just a high pressured environment. And I was not used to that. But again, becoming a doctor, you are grilled. You can switch into any situation. You can switch into skin of steel mode. You can switch into empathy. You can switch into you have different ways of managing situations. So as a house officer, you don't have much of a choice. If you have to collect 20 patients, you will. So it was just, it's like military. It's very hierarchical. This work you have to no excuses. Lives are dependent on your every move. So I would say it was stressful. It was tough. But the way we go about it is like we'll go through it. We won't die. As in, just before you die from the work, you will be moved out of the work. So no one really dies from hard work. So I would say, yeah, it was
Yes.
tedious, but I think I had a life-changing experience then. So I was in the pediatrics unit, and I was in the HIV unit of the pediatric hospital. And I was careless of being a young doctor. I was very careless. I bled a child who was HIV positive. And in the process of rushing to bleed the next child, I pricked myself. I didn't cap the needle. So I pricked myself with the very needle I bled the child who was HIV positive. So I lost. In fact, I just went numb, and I screamed and I went numb. So the nurses ran to the bay, to the last bay, and what happened? And I said, I pricked myself. They grabbed me and, took me to the sink. They poured this, they bled the finger, they, did all types of things. And I just stood there like, oh my goodness. Eh, beautiful girl, is this how you're going to get HIV? Eh? You've not even started life. And then I had to go on the HIV drugs, for a few months to reduce my risk. And luckily, thank God, I didn't get infected from that incident. But I learned a very, very big lesson there. You just have to protect yourself. Yes, we've sworn an oath, so do no harm and take care of our patients. But there's also that part where you have to do things in a way that you care for yourself. Because if we have too many occupational hazards as healthcare professionals, and I just hope the pressures that come with the medical system, the training, can sort of be reduced. Mental health for healthcare professionals can be invested in, and then everyone gets joy from working as a medical doctor, as human beings, not as machines.
But do you really get, maybe the joy comes later, because when I look at all the medical school seems to be tough, like so tough, and it seems to be designed that way to basically either break you, get you out, or really build you up. And then once you start, then it seems to be even tougher. Like the hours are crazy. Sometimes you're on call for like 48 hours, 72 hours. At least that's what I hear from friends who are medical doctors. And then that's also how it's depicted in films, whether, that's what you experience. So it seems really tough. So do you get any joy maybe until you're, I don't know, a very senior doctor, you own a private practice? Because the whole process from the outside looking in anyway seems just really tough.
And that's what I think I would say with self-awareness. If you're in medicine because you want to be a doctor, you'll be happy every day, even if they're owing you salaries. So we all get our joy from different areas, and our careers fulfill us in different ways. So some people are just happy every day because they're impacting lives, and that is that's like their value. That's what they want to do. Some people get into medicine and they're like, no way, this is not for me. This work is too hard. Come on, I can make the same money faster, or I can make the same money with less stress. So the people who stay back in medicine stay back because it's really from their heart. They want to do it, and whatever the challenge is, no matter how daunting it is, you'll find a lot of healthcare professionals staying back because that is what they want to do. They are self-aware. They know it's their calling. They know that's where they want to be. Sometimes if you lure them even into the private setting, some of them want to be in the public setting serving. They want to remain public servants. So some people are academicians. They don't want to do the clinical practice. They want to collect their salary, which is, let me call it decent salary. And that's all they want to do. They want to contribute to knowledge, do research. And that's it. Some doctors want to, make money and at the same time bring value. And you'll find them scattered around different parts, public setting, or they're working in the pharmaceutical industry. So it's back to you as an individual, what you want to achieve with your degree, where you want to play.
So what did you want to achieve with your degree? Why were you a medical doctor?
Okay, so I would say let me jump into my work in the oncology space. I chose oncology because I lost my sister to cancer in medical school, and while it was a traumatic experience, that birthed my ex that just sort of launched me into the oncology space. She went through we all went through a trying time as a family. While in medical school, I then started taking notice of cancer patients and what they were going through. I went back to the hospital where she was treated, volunteered with them, spent more time volunteering in different cancer clinics, and I decided that I think I should specialize in oncology. And at the time I chose that, yeah, it was one, I was trying to recover from my pain. I wanted to face like the most painful thing that had happened to me. So I realized there was a lot of suffering, and I wanted to apply myself to helping the patients. Three, I see it that God has blessed me with knowledge. He's taken me through that experience with my sister, and the path cancer patients pass is very dark, and somehow I can play a role in lighting or illuminating that dark path. And that's why I have stayed in oncology for this long. So that journey of wanting to help birth the NGO, Chebekli Cancer Care, which was before I started my specialty program. And after spending 2 years in the NGO, I said, you know what, I need to do more. Let me go and sit with cancer patients, know their problems, treat them. And then I did my specialty program in Louth, fantastic place. Spent 6 plus years training on oncology. So I graduated as a consultant radiation oncologist. In between that, I was developing programs and projects in the NGO to, just help cancer patients, either through treatment support programs or cancer prevention programs. And in treating cancer patients, you get to know what they're going through. And I could just apply, and knowing fully well that I'm not just a doctor, I like to create, I like busy. So one of the projects I came up with was Oncopaddy, which is a digital platform, provides telemedicine and other things. So yeah, that's my journey. It's really to help people this dark road when they're dealing with cancer.
That's really admirable work that you're doing. Yeah, I totally understand. I mentioned to you that my father, also had cancer, and when you said that the whole family was going through the treatment together, I totally understand. We spent so many nights in the hospital, and yeah, those were days that. Yeah, they were tough, and yeah, I don't think we like thinking back on them, very much. So it's incredible, what you're doing with them, Shebeckley, and also, in your work as an oncologist. And so how are you managing to run Shebeckley and at the same time work as an oncologist in Luz? I can imagine both were, required a lot of time. And I know starting a new initiative, like a new NGO, nonprofit, it's like a baby. You really have to spend a lot of time. You nurture it, you put a lot into it. How are you managing to balance your time so you could give to both?
I would say that what worked for me was the fact that Chebekli Cancer Care was established before I started my program in my work as a trainee doctor in oncology. So we had some foundation, we had laid the foundation, had a small team, and luckily some of the first set of staff in Chebekli Cancer Care were cancer survivors, were people who had benefited from the NGO, had in one way or the other, they had either maybe been supported or we had cancelled them. And so when I started my program in Louth, the first 2 years I was not available in the NGO, but there was a team. And they were committed, they were passionate about, when it comes to cancer, it's a big problem, and they were as committed as I was, and they held the organization for. Our expenses at the time was low. The programs we were running were not huge programs. There were more to do with information counseling. We were partnering with hospitals, and our survivors would come in to counsel cancer patients because they had been trained to, counsel newly diagnosed patients. It was more to do with, awareness, community programs, which I had some time over the weekend to do. I would say it's always been, I've always juggled it. It had its advantage and its disadvantage. And then
So Shebekli has really. Sorry.
it got to a point where we then brought in, like program managers, project managers, and we sort of expanded the scope of our work and then brought in a manager for each project. And then we got successful in raising funds that sustained us. We had some legacy sponsors. So we didn't have to raise funds actively when I was away. So we sort of had raised funds securely for a few years, and our programs were moving smoothly. Also, the fact that I'm an oncologist, it was just obvious that I was invested in oncology. So that also gave us some goodwill. And at that time, it wasn't as difficult as raising funds as it is now. So I would say we've always had a lot of goodwill, and that has kept us afloat.
So, how did you find your legacy sponsors?
Well, struggle. Again, I will say not that we set out to even find them. Some of our legacy sponsors found us. They reach out to us and they say, "Oh, we heard of the great work you're doing. A relative of mine benefited from your program, or you counseled someone, or one of your survivors did this." And the truth, the best and the biggest of our legacy sponsors found us. We didn't go out after them. They found us. And that's something we still enjoy till date. And that's a bit of a disadvantage, because when you are in that position, then you're not going as hard and as fast as you should, or becoming very aggressive with raising funds. But again, we're 15 years as an NGO, and our strategy is changing. We're looking at our sustainability very seriously, and on the entrepreneurship aspect of how to ensure that Shebekli is a legacy. We're bringing in experts to help us, forecast and position ourselves in a way where we are here forever.
How are you doing that? So you're bringing in experts. What other way is Shebekli growing? I see that your programs are expanding to other parts of the country. I see Shebekli, in different states. So tell us a bit about the growth of Shebekli's work.
Okay, so I think another pillar to Shebekli is the people who come in, which is part of the goodwill. The team members, they are committed to the vision. Some have lost people to cancer, or some are just genuinely interested in cancer, maybe in research or in programs or in counseling. And in one way or the other, we usually find ourselves at the table. We're all committed to this vision. They say I'm a great leader. I'm able to, carry people along for us to achieve a vision. But I say that we are lucky that we are able to attract people who, by force, want to help. They are committed to helping before they even know what the vision is. And their ideas, their hard work, is what is making us expand. For example, we've attempted Guinness World Record. At the time we started that plan, it wasn't even my idea, it was another team member's idea. And we said, we sat at the table, very informal meeting, and we said, "Okay, what are we doing this year? Something exciting." And someone said, "Let's attempt a Guinness World Record." I was like, "Don't try it, though. That's a lot of money." But they came back with a plan. And I said, "Look, it will cost this amount. We have only 10% of these funds." They said, "Don't worry, our goodwill will speak for us." The rest is history. We attempted Guinness World Record by gathering 7,598 people at Teslim Balogun Stadium. We all wore pink T-shirts. We formed a human ribbon. At the time, the government was asking us then to pay millions of naira to use the pitch. And within 2 weeks, they called us back and said there's no need to pay. And we got a lot of, technical support from people. And it was a team that brought that. So every time we expand, it's really our goodwill. It's our commitment to our own vision. It's our ability to tell our stories. It's the team. It's the team. And my team, we've had all types of people come in, different age, different tribes. It's the team. I think that's like a major pillar in Shebekli. We have cancer survivors who have been part of our support group for the past 10 years. And up till date, they are still referring, newly diagnosed people to Shebekli. Oh, we met this woman. She doesn't want to take treatment, but she'll benefit from counseling in Shebekli. So it's the, I say it's the goodwill. It's our goodwill. I think God gave that to us.
Wow,
That's
fantastic.
one of the gifts God gave us. Like, okay, use this goodwill. It's not money, but you see, this goodwill is bigger than money. So we do so many things. That I don't know how to explain it, but the things we do, the impact we make is always more than the money we get because there's that there's it's just that touch from God.
So tell us about Uncle Paddy. You mentioned that a while ago. Tell us about it.
Okay, so Uncle Paddy, a lot of women with cancer, breast cancer, for example. There was this day I was in clinic, and it was one of the, frustrating days. I'd seen too many patients with advanced breast cancer, and it just didn't. It wasn't adding up. And it got to a point where I said, "Why are you presenting this way?" And I kept asking each woman as she, as they came into my consulting room. And when I round up the consultation, I said, "So, why didn't you come to the hospital early? Why are you just coming? This lump has been there for 7 months. Look at what it has become. Why?" And what was common to all of them was we didn't know that this lump was, it could be cancer. We didn't know which doctor to even go to. Okay, so I have a breast lump. I don't know where to go to. So why do you expect me to know that it's cancer? And some other woman said, "Oh, yeah. I even went to a doctor, but the doctor didn't release me to the right doctor, didn't refer me." And so after that clinic, as I was walking into my car, I was like, "What are we going to do, to simplify cancer care? Any woman with a breast lump should know that a doctor should examine her, should take some history about the breast lump, should send her to do breast scan and mammogram, and take a biopsy. When they do the biopsy, get the result. It's that result that will confirm whether it's cancer or not." And I said, "Okay, maybe if we put this online, we have a website." And then I called the team and I said, "I have this idea. What do you think?" And they said, "It's a good idea, but we have other projects. Dr. Salako, don't come with this, your new idea." So the first year, we didn't do much about it. The second year, that was in 2015. The second year, we didn't do anything about it because we had other programs that were priority. But by 2017, I became restless and I, mandated. I said, "We have to do this." And that's how we started Uncle Paddy. It has morphed. It's a telemedicine platform. We're able to conduct video consultations with cancer patients. There are many people in the community today who are lost. They have cancer or they've just been diagnosed. They need to be counseled. They have questions. They don't know who to turn to. They don't know who the oncologists are. They've never even heard that cancer specialists are called oncologists. They don't even know the cancer hospitals. And when they know the cancer hospitals, they feel they will die there. So we need a platform where people feel comfortable, they feel safe, they feel confident that there are specialists who will not scare them, maybe will not cut off your breast. When you come on the platform, we'll connect you to a survivor who has gone through the journey. And that's like our superpower, survivors. and they tell a newly diagnosed patient that these are the things you will go through. I went through stories and experiences. It's just one of the most important things in cancer. It makes people make the right decision. When they make the right decision, they can get referred to the right hospital. So that when I'm sitting in my clinic, I'm not getting breast cancer patients with stage 4. I would rather get them with stage 1. Then we can perform some magic, treat them, hopefully cure them. But when they come in stage 4, it's too late. So Uncle Paddy is bridging that gap, you know, just pumping the patients into the hospitals, get into the hospital early, see the right doctors. We have 80 radiation oncologists in Nigeria. It doesn't make sense when a cancer patient is being treated by any other doctor. When there is an oncologist or there is a surgeon who is skilled in cancer care. So the community has a lot of cancer patients, but the community does not know where the right cancer doctors are. So if we want to win the fight against cancer, we have to get our people informed, empowered, educated. We have to engage them. You can't just tell a woman that she has a lump in her breast and for that reason, I'm going to cut off your breast. Come on. You need to take her through a journey. So on Uncle Paddy, we have all types of materials. We are building videos to take women through that process. Even at that, it doesn't mean the woman will make up her mind to start treatment.
So it seems like for a lot of women, access to information is a big problem. And being able to advocate for themselves is another problem. I've heard so many stories about women who went to doctors, like they didn't feel that there was something right in their body. And the doctor just fobbed them off like, you know, maybe you're tired, maybe it's a time of the month, maybe you need to rest or whatever. And then you just mentioned now that, you know, some women went to their doctors and the doctors maybe sent them to the wrong doctor or didn't give them the information that they needed to make the best choice for themselves. How do you advise your female patients to deal with this?
Okay, so the first thing is there are two types of patients. We have the e-patients, right? They are people who go online to gather information or resources related to their healthcare. And these are people who have access to internet, a smartphone, or a tablet. For those people, once they go online, they will find a whole lot of information. The issue there is some of the information is wrong, some right. So for these e-patients, to solve their problems, we have to come up with reliable, credible websites that they can trust. They need to see faces. They need to know names. They need to know they can trust this website. That's one thing we are working on, and we're, you know, sort of gathering on Uncle Paddy, see the people behind it. We're also affiliated with this. So, then there are those patients who don't want to know, they don't want to gather information, or they are not connected. They don't have access to the internet, but they have, and they just don't want to find out what's happening. But what I would say is our healthcare system is burden. It has a lot of challenges. So if you have a health condition, please, it is your responsibility, your personal responsibility to find the right information. Whether you're going to walk into a hospital and ask, or you go online, or you reach out to a healthcare professional in your community, in your primary healthcare center, I always say people should take advantage of the public hospitals. You need to go into some of the primary healthcare centers and see how they have improved. People are living with the stories, the versions of healthcare centers or hospitals that are as old as 10, 20 years ago. There's been a lot of improvement. Go in and ask your questions. I noticed they lump, what should I do? Most healthcare professionals know where to refer. Most. There are a few who make, you know, who do the wrong things, who practice the wrong things for selfish interest. You know, so I would say there has to be, we're at a point where you just have to be your own advocate. You have to find the right information. You know, as I'm an oncologist, on a daily basis, someone is calling me to ask, oh, I have a relative who has cancer. And that's because they know me. But there are many people who don't have access to an oncologist, but they have a phone. So if you go online and you Google cancer clinic in Lagos and Nigeria, you'll find some credible websites. And I think that's a place where people can start from. Then people are entitled to second opinion. Your instincts are usually right. If a doctor tells you something you don't like, please seek a second opinion, because we get a lot of patients in the late stage. And when we ask them, where have you been? They will say, oh, they were drinking one type of water, or they were with this doctor. If only they had stepped out of that comfort zone to say, I'm looking for a second opinion. Go into another hospital, go online and just search oncologist, or if it's diabetes doctor, and do your due diligence. Ask questions. The era of a patient looking up to a healthcare professional as a demigod is over. Digital health can equalize the patient-doctor relationship. When you're going in to see a doctor, you should have 10 to 20 questions you want to ask. Engage them. Ask the history behind the doctor. This is not about, oh, I'm 80 years old, I'm a professor of this, or I'm a professor of that. How many surgeries have you successfully done? What, from your experience, what are the complications associated with the surgery? There are some questions you ask. When you listen to the answer, you'll have a good feeling about it, or you'll say, I'm not comfortable with this person. And that's one thing Uncle Paddy is doing. Care is too bureaucratic, it's too centralized. What we're trying to do is, if you're not even happy with a healthcare practitioner, feel free to move. Because at the end of the day, it's your health, it's your life, it's not the healthcare professional. Follow the advice. If you're in the hands of a good doctor, great. If you don't feel comfortable, do not be subjected to seeing someone who belittles you, who speaks to you rudely, all in the name of you're getting, that person is treating you, and because of that, you are now a slave. That sort of healthcare professional.
But but there's some women who are better able to speak up for themselves than other women. So, I mean, I'm thinking of a woman who is educated to maybe like a second degree, she's very confident, articulate, and then you have other groups of women who maybe they finish primary school and then that's it. So their belief in the doctor as an expert is total. So either maybe they're suspicious of all medical professionals in general, or their belief is total that whatever the doctor says goes. So a woman like that, how would she start to think of even asking those kind of questions, or maybe even knowing when she's not getting the best kind of
And
care?
this is where family comes in. So, when someone is going through a condition like cancer, support is critical. You see, treatment is just one part of it. Chemotherapy, surgery, and radiotherapy. Support from home is critical. I see more patients dying faster because they lack support from home than they're dying from the cancer. When people are coming, when we even want to break bad news to a patient and maybe want to say, oh, this lump is breast cancer, we usually ask them to come with the reality. Because when we engage them and we counsel them, we want a second pair of ears to listen in, because the woman we're talking to has blanked out. So it's great when we see relatives coming with the patients, and those relatives have questions, are listening to the counsel, like, do this when you get home, use your medication this way. So for people that fall into that group, well, we pray they are in the hands of the right doctors. So let's start with, at least they should be in the right hospital. They should be treated by a cancer doctor. And then come in with people who can help, like a learned family member or children. Children ask great questions. Adult children, siblings, friends, work colleagues, fellow businesswoman, or a survivor who has worked. Of course, in some cases, patients don't have any of this. The hope, and what usually happens, is when they are in the right hospital, they still continue to get the right type of care. So even though there are some sharp and bad practices, that's not what happens in all the hospitals I am. As much as sharp practices are not
Okay.
specific to medical practice, it happens everywhere. But I would say in most of the public hospitals, there's a department called radiotherapy or radiation oncology, cancer department. That's always a good place to start from. Usually in the teaching hospitals, either state or federal, is where you'll find the cancer department. That's usually a place to start from. But there are all these other types of private hospitals that do all types of things. You can't monitor what's happening. The specialist there is not even a cancer specialist. You can't compare a surgeon who every week he does breast cancer surgery to another surgeon who does breast cancer surgery once a quarter. Where would you find the expert surgeons? You'll find most of them in the public hospital. So when it comes to cancer, I usually recommend going to the public hospital to go and find your doctors. The equipment are there, the treatment is there, and care in the public hospital is cheaper.
All right, so I want to ask you how you manage everything you're doing. You've spoken about your work, working as an oncologist, and then also working, running Chebecley, and then with Uncle Paddy as well. So how do you manage your family as well? I mean, in the African context, being a wife and a mother means that you have a lot of responsibilities, things that are expected of you. So how are you running your family in that in the context of everything else that you're doing?
Well, family is everything, is my priority. At the end of the day, family comes first. So I'm blessed with a very understanding husband. God, just placed me in his warm, loving arms, and have immense support from him. I also have my priorities and responsibilities to my family, my kids, and I do not joke with that. I'm as close as I can be with my kids, with my husband, my parents. I have a good support system. I believe in the traditional community way of raising children, and it starts with creating time. So I take my time to spend a minimum of 3 to 4 hours a day with the kids. On weekends, it's longer. On some days, I can't achieve as much as 3 hours, but it's a deliberate thing. I have a good support system at home. I have an excellent support system at work. I do not work by myself for myself. I always have a team that can carry on activities whether I'm there or not. So I would say I'm blessed with my family members. They support me. They support my dreams and ambitions. Sometimes I overwork. I go into this overdrive with my work, and they pull me back when I'm in that mode. But sometimes they are like, okay, we know this is not going to last too long. We'll let you be and do what you have to do and come back. And when I'm with my family, I am present. I try to be as present as possible. I just left my daughter and we painted, we built something, molded, and so I'm very conscious about the time I spend. Because with my parents, it was also, it's one thing I can hold on to, that my parents had time for me. They taught me certain words. They gave me responsibilities. I said, go, try it. I remember one day my dad set a trap for me. He gave me, let's say, 2,000 naira. He said, go and give someone. I got there, I gave the person. And the guy said, your dad was supposed to give me 4,000 naira. And I said, no. Yeah, I said, well, he gave me 2,000. And then I went back to my dad and I said, Daddy, the guy is asking for 2K more. But I gave you 4,000. I was like, no, you gave me 2K. And I was like, are you saying I stole the money? And he was like, did you count the money when I gave it to you? I was like, no. He said, you trusted me, right? I said, yes. He said, you shouldn't trust when it comes to money. Count it first. There's nothing like father and daughter in this relationship. And I was like, what kind of man is this one? Because I was looking like the thief in between my father who was denying and the man who didn't receive. Being purposeful, like every time we engage, we're either just chilling or we're learning something or we're teaching something. So I would say I have a very understanding and supportive family, and I'm very intentional about building my support system and team members at home, at work. I'm also very deliberate about the time I spend with kids. I would not say I'm a great time manager. I struggle with that. I would love to, work in a way that, 8 to 4, this is what I'm doing. I can predict my schedule. But sometimes on Monday, maybe I'm to run through documents or run through the process of input padding. Something may be a grant application. I've just discovered the grant deadline, and I'm going to drop input padding and face that deadline. And the team, I'm going to pull them from all what they're doing. I'm like, we have to do this, we have to do this. So for me, that's one problem. When I come up with a lot of ideas and I like to run with those ideas, and I don't want to be told, oh, it's not yet time. I want to try it. If I pass, I pass. If I fail, I fail. I don't want to waste time. I'd rather try 10 things and fail at 5, get 5 right, than to perfectly get 4. So that gets in the way. And I think if I manage my time well and I'm not running after every beautiful idea that comes up, I would be able to save more time, finish projects faster, not have a lot of work on my table. And I think that would give me more time. But I don't know. I'm on that journey.
So what's next for you over the next few years? What are your big plans?
Freedom.
Freedom.
That's something that has been ringing in my ear. Freedom to do everything my heart desires, irrespective of my designation, my title. My heart says, well, I climb up that mountain and sit up there and paint the sun. I want the freedom, the ability to do it. And when I say that, I want to have the time, the money, the resources to do what my heart desires. The good thing is my heart is good, so I usually do good things. So if I have that freedom, I'm not held down by... I have to sort of go to work. I have to calculate this money before I can achieve this. I have this workload. It's so much. I can't take a break. I want freedom. Tomorrow, I don't know what I'll come up with. I don't know the next idea. It's not clear. But if I come up with an idea, I want to run with it, and I want the resources to run with it. And I do not want to be boxed by my achievements. And that's something that I see many women are trapped in, and I speak for myself. So I'm an oncologist that should be practicing in a hospital, but I'm more than an oncologist. I'm in the tech space, I'm a project person, but it's just abnormal. It's weird to be in the clinical space and then be doing all what I'm doing. So sometimes it's a struggle for people to accept the path I'm towing, and I have to, sort of fight and defend, or just be rebellious and say, you know what, I'm doing it anyway. But it would be great if people are allowed to bring their true self to work, to the table, and not be misinterpreted as, who the hell do you think you are? Why do you come up with these ideas? It's not time for this. And that's something I heard when I came up with Uncle Paddy. Yeah, like telemedicine, cancer patients, you want to niche video consultation on cancer patient, you can't be serious. How much have you spent? I said it. They say you can't be serious. Come on now, who knew about COVID pandemic? Who knew a time like this cancer hospitals will need it? So some people are blessed, have gifts of whatever. You just must allow such people. Everyone has a gift another person doesn't have. But that does not mean everyone should be put in a box. There are seasons where you'll be put in a box, but there should also be seasons where you're allowed to thrive. And this is not just applying to work, it's applying to all areas of woman's life. To be able to thrive in what your heart desires.
What was it like moving from medicine to the tech space with Uncle Paddy? I can imagine that a few years ago, it may have seemed like such a crazy idea, but now technology is seen, you know, it intersects with every aspect of our life. So, you know, it's less far-fetched to see, you know, medicine and technology intersecting. But the tech startup space in Nigeria, you know, it's specific. You see a lot of the same faces, a lot of the same types of people when you go for events. So how was it for you moving into that space for the first time?
Moving into the tech space was like rolling down a mountain. So being a medical doctor and a consultant, we go through this rigorous process, which is like, I can describe it as climbing a mountain, and I'm high up on the mountain, you know, enjoying the view, taking in the fresh air. And then this idea of Uncle Paddy comes up, and I'm like, okay, let me help my cancer patients. You know, let's create a website that would educate them, refer them to the right hospital. And in building that, that's how I stepped into tech. But I can describe it like I rolled off from the peak of the mountain and sort of rolled down and got to the base of that mountain. Because it's just been discussing with tech guys, building the website, they're not getting it right. We've wasted money. We had to reconstruct the website. I think we've done that two or three times. It was new. In fact, I felt old in the tech space because I was like, what's happening here? And people were like, oh, you have a good idea. You should come to this event. And I'm like, okay. Making me crazy. Okay, so in medicine, you're allowed to talk for as long as you want. You usually have 30 minutes to make a presentation. But in the tech space, max 5 minutes, 10 minutes. So that for me was a struggle. The language people were using in tech events, I didn't know anyone in the tech space. But because I knew I had a good idea and I'd spoken to some people and they thought it was a good idea, I said, okay, so I'm a doctor going into tech space. How do I pick myself up from this mountain I have rolled from? And the first thing I did was I found a mentor. And I was specific. I found Dr. Mobola Johnson, former minister, ICT, and it was a random event. Access Bank was celebrating International Women's Day, and they made a call that if you want to meet any of these women, apply. And I was specific. I was like, I need to meet this woman. I need some form of education. I need advice. I need to see into the future. I've started a bit too late. You know, I need someone who's been on this journey. And I remember going to her and I told her about Uncle Paddy. And it was a group meeting, but I was deliberate. I said, Ma, I need you for 6 months. Give me 2 to 3 hours every month. I need to birth this idea. And the first time we met was, I just pitched the game with my mouth. And she was like, okay, go and do this. The next month, I came back with a plan, which I presented. The third month, I came up with the first version of the website. So I would say, it was because of the mentorship I got from Dr. Mobola Johnson. Then I was very deliberate about building new networks, friends, professional friends in the tech space. And you, Ore, I've always had you on my radar, like, Ore, as in, oh, Ore is doing this. So I'm following you on your social media profiles and I'm watching you because you're a role model. And I'm like, you've been in this for a long time. And when I have my weird questions, my vulnerable questions, I have you to go to, and some other women. So I built a network of, you know, peers, people I can rely on, like, hey, they're asking me this. Oh, I don't know how to write the pitch deck. Oh, who do I talk to get this done? So I built that also. I then held on to the idea because there were a lot of naysayers, like, look, you have a stable job. And this one that you're doing, that you're spending your money, you're chasing an idea that, you know, no, all of that didn't get to me. I also found a great co-founder, Dr. Ada. Again, a team member in Shebekli Cancer Care. She handled the project from the beginning. And I said, you know what, you merit this, as in I can't do without you. You have earned your seat at the table. And so that's again something that has worked. Yeah, that I would say. And then I just started going for all the tech events. I think in 2019 I went for so many events, as in that was the year for Uncle Paddy. Was it, I think, 2018 or 2019? And I was at almost every tech event that was related to digital health. If I don't have a question, I will just raise my hand and give a comment and talk about Uncle Paddy. I was particular about being visible. Yeah, so and through those events, I also found some great opportunities. Some were local, some were international. So just, continuously telling the story was something that helped also. And what I would say from my own experience is I'm playing in my area of strength. I'm an oncologist. I want to solve a cancer problem. I'm not trying to become a technical person. I'm not trying to code. I don't even want that thing is hard. I don't know how you do it. So anyone going into tech from another industry, just play on your strength. Find people who can play in their areas of strength, form a great team, a core team, have a layer of advisors, have a layer of mentors, and then be out there, tell your stories. And then there are times where you don't need to be out there, you need to be building for sort of ration your time. This year is very exciting for us at Uncle Paddy. The pandemic has made our consultations peak. Funds we're getting in from the platform has peaked also. We had been building. We didn't know our highest utilization rate was starting April. We thought maybe it would be quarter three of this year. We were prepared when the pandemic came. So I would just say, face your front, know what you bring to the table, know what's in you, believe in yourself. Even when people are saying, don't do it, it's this, it's that, just face, focus on what God has placed in your hands. And I say, you create great ideas from problems. You have to be responsive to your environment. There are many solutions we can come up with, but you have to test it. You have to talk it through with people. You have to bounce ideas off other people. Eventually, when you get it right, then hopefully we become, like a Google,
Oh yes, oh yes. We're looking forward to So thank you so much, Lola. You've shared so much. It's been an incredible conversation, talking about your start, your move into medicine, technology, and everything in between. It's really been a great talk. So thank you so much for the time you've spent sharing with us. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
Indeed, I did, Ore. I did. Thank you so much for inviting me. And thank you for all the great work you do with the girls and the young women. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me on The Other Room in conversation with Dr. Omolola Salako. Lola spoke about the importance of gaining clarity in your career choice and how this can help you go the extra mile when you experience any challenges. She also spoke about the importance of women being their best advocates when it comes to receiving health care. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please subscribe to The Other Room on your favorite podcast app. Until next time, live your life with boldness and joy.